From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As President Bush pushes for his $1.6 trillion tax break, the shelter population in New York City reaches its highest level since the late 1980s, and homelessness increases around the country. Also, governors make emergency cuts in their state budgets. Also, a look at Ecuador with military cracking down, killing at least four indigenous people as thousands protest austerity cuts imposed by the International Monetary Fund. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Washington Post is reporting today that President Bush intends to appoint Larry D. Thompson, an Atlanta lawyer who's African-American, to the high-profile post of Deputy Attorney General. The move appears designed in part to counter criticism that Attorney General John D. Ashcroft is insensitive to race. Thompson, a partner in the Atlanta law firm of King and Spalding, is best known in Washington for serving as an advisor and a witness for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas during his contentious Senate confirmation hearings. Thompson is a lawyer and political conservative and a native of Missouri. Thompson resigned from the Southeastern Legal Foundation in 1999 before it filed suit over Atlanta's minority contracting program. The Georgia Black Chamber of Commerce had threatened a boycott of all companies that had any affiliation with the foundation because of its opposition to minority contracting. A man who has spent 9.5 years on Virginia's death row is scheduled to be set free today. Earl Washington Jr. was pardoned by Governor Jim Gilmore after DNA tests showed he was wrongly convicted of raping and murdering a woman in 1982. Washington, who has an IQ of 69, confessed to the murder of Rebecca Williams, even though no fingerprints or biological evidence ever tied him to the crime. His case has sparked new debate over capital punishment in Virginia. The Virginia Senate has backed legislation to wipe out the 21-day limit the state now places on condemned inmates to present new evidence of their innocence. The relief agency Oxfam is taking aim at the pharmaceutical industry and governments of developed nations, accusing them of keeping life-saving medicines beyond the reach of the world's poor. In the latest chapter in a growing campaign to broaden access to essential medicines, Oxfam said today that drug companies and wealthy nations are, quote, conducting an undeclared drug war against the world's poorest countries. Oxfam urged the World Trade Organization to change its patent rules to allow developing countries to produce low-cost versions of drugs that fight major killers such as AIDS, respiratory tract infections, and childhood diarrhea. South Africa, Brazil, Thailand, and many other countries currently face lawsuits and trade sanction threats for attempting to produce cheaper medicines for their people. Current WTO rules give 20-year protection to patents. Iraq says U.S. and British warplanes injured 7 people and destroyed 17 houses in airstrikes yesterday in the southern part of the country. According to a military spokesperson, bombs hit civilian buildings and military installations in the provinces of Basra and Maysan, injuring 4 men, 2 women, and a 4-year-old child. The U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida, claim that U.S. and British planes struck anti-aircraft artillery sites in southern Iraq in response to anti-aircraft artillery fire against its planes. A new sound joined the Hungarian airwaves last night with the launch of Radio C, a station run by and directed at the city's large gypsy population. The station, on the air for a trial period but in the running for a permanent frequency in Budapest, represents the second place in Europe for gypsies or Roma to have their own full-time radio broadcasts. Several such stations already operate in Macedonia. Hungary has more than 500,000 Roma, most of them marginalized and poor. Though known worldwide as gypsies, the United Nations, other international organizations, and the ethnic group themselves prefer the name Roma, which means the people in the Romani language they speak. Although they're Hungary's largest ethnic minority, state-run radio and television currently run only a 30-minute weekly magazine program on issues affecting them. In addition to social issues like housing, jobs, and social policy, Radio C will open discussion of racism and other topics relevant to the Roma population. And finally, in a victory for independent media, the Czech TV crisis has come to an end. The new head of Czech television has ousted the top managers whose political ties had touched off a tumultuous employee strike. Pledging to take a tough line, the new interim director ended disruption in the newsroom by dumping managers loyal to the former chief, Jiří Hodáč. The action late Friday marked a final concession to the strikers, who had rejected Hodáč's appointment because of his political ties and went on strike for editorial independence. Scores of journalists occupied the newsroom, staying there overnight since Christmas. Soon after Hodáč's December 20th appointment, journalists demanding editorial independence barricaded themselves in the newsroom, arguing he was too closely tied to the former prime minister. Czechs swept into the streets from massive protests to back the strikers. 100,000 people packed the square outside to demand the general manager's ouster. The striking journalists announced Friday they would end their strike after promises their demands would be met and that no one would lose their jobs.
Trying to drive me away from home. Blues trying to drive me away from home. And the blues so bad. Blues followed me all day long. Take my rest. The blues won't let me take my rest.
Eric Clapton singing Blues Leave Me Alone here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As President Bush pushes for his $1.6 trillion tax cut, every day headlines announce the end of the boom economy. But for many in America, the crucial question throughout the Clinton administration was, what boom? Welfare to work programs never delivered the promised ladder up, and minimum wage jobs keep many mired in poverty. At the same time, those who grew rich on stock market and dot-com profits drove rents and real estate out of reach for most poor people. Every year since 1994, housing costs have increased at a rate 40% greater than inflation. Now, there's no state where a minimum wage job allows a person to rent a two-bedroom apartment. The result has been millions of people forced to live in substandard, overcrowded housing or no housing at all. Official statistics document 2.5 to 3 million homeless people, but the real number is undoubtedly higher and rising. The U.S. Conference of Mayors reports a 17% increase in the number of families asking for help because of homelessness. Families or single women now make up more than three-quarters of New York City's homeless, and by far the most likely person to become homeless is a poor black child younger than 5 years old. Yesterday's or last week's New York Times had a front-page story: shelter population in New York City reaches highest level since the late 1980s. Adding to the crisis is the Clinton administration's end of welfare as we know it. Some 60,000 families across the country have already lost their benefits, and this December, more than 71,000 families with roughly two children each will have been on welfare for 5 years, the federal limit enacted in the 1996 overhaul of the system. Both Bush administration is likely to make things only worse for the poor through tax policies that will redistribute money upward and propose budget that will further shred the social safety net. Now an economic downturn is looming. Job layoffs are increasing. Within this gloomy context, the conjunction of tax policies, rising homelessness, and welfare reform threaten to exacerbate an already dire situation for America's poor. We're going to have a roundtable discussion about this issue today, and we're going to begin with Alan Frank, professor at Emmanuel College in Boston, Massachusetts, and a member of the Dollars and Cents magazine collective. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan Frank.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, let's start out by talking about President Bush's tax proposals, the proposed $1.6 trillion tax cut.
Well, Bush is proposing a tax cut that will essentially reduce the rates, tax rates paid by most taxpayers, but especially by the top 1% of taxpayers. Bush is proposing that the top rate of right now almost 40% be reduced to 33%. And this top rate only applies to people whose income is $300,000 a year approximately or above, about 1% of taxpayers. So this is going to be disproportionately beneficial to upper income taxpayers. He's also proposing to repeal the estate tax, a tax that falls only on about 2% of all estates. Bush's proposal is based on this idea that there's a huge surplus and there will be budget surpluses for years to come, which is likely to be true. But the surpluses have materialized largely because of budget cuts that were made in the 1990s as a result of the balanced budget agreement. Under the Clinton administration, spending on things like housing, for example, and Head Start and other so-called discretionary programs were frozen. And the Congressional Budget Office is projecting that they will remain frozen, that they will not increase with the population or with the general economy, but will shrink over the next decade. Medicaid and Medicare programs were cut, and reimbursements to providers were cut as a way to shrink the budget deficit and put the budget into surplus. And nobody is proposing that any of these cuts be restored. Instead, what is being proposed is a tax cut, which will mostly benefit the upper classes.
Hmm. We're also joined, Alan Frank, by Eva DeLuna, who is an analyst for the Center for Public Policy Priorities, which is an advocacy group for poor Texans. There is a headline story today, Some Fault Bush Tax Cuts for Lean Days in Texas. And it says, while President Bush is lobbying Congress to pass his $1.6 trillion tax cut proposal on Washington, lawmakers in his home state are struggling with budget problems that some critics are tracing to tax cuts Bush passed as governor in Texas. For the last week, state legislators have grown increasingly testy about budget projections showing the state will have little, if any, money to spare. Lawmakers in both parties are talking of possible cutbacks after the projections showed the state's once healthy surplus might be nearly erased by budget overruns, particularly from health care costs like Medicaid. Eva DeLuna, what is your take on what has happened in Texas?
I'd say our general word of caution to anyone who ever says that Texas has a surplus is that we could have spent every extra dollar or new dollar that we had. We don't call it surplus because it could have been spent on our health and human service programs and it's still not had us anywhere near the average in terms of what we do for the poor. Because it was new money, they got the idea that they could put a little more into some programs. Public education was a good example. We had a teacher pay raise. But a lot of the other Medicaid, our TANF cash welfare program, a lot of those were only able to be, either stay the same or improved in terms of funding because of these federal funds that are available. So what the first speaker said really concerns us. If a federal surplus is predicated on big cuts in non-entitlement programs, that really endangers our entire state budget because it's almost all federal money that's in there. In 1999, this is the other thing we point out, we were 48th in terms of state per capita tax burden. We really didn't have that much further down to go. So we consistently pointed out we do not need tax cuts. We already have one of the lowest tax burdens in the country. But the idea that we had a lot of extra money compared to what we've been spending the previous 2 years is what made them think they could do large tax cuts for big corporations, an R&D tax credit, targeted investment, manufacturing, things like that, that didn't really reach the average, I guess, the poor Texan that we're concerned about. A lot of business tax cuts as opposed to things that would have made our system less regressive. So that, I guess, the big picture is we had 3 million poor Texans in 1995. We still have 3 million poor Texans in 1999. It's just much less likely that they're getting Medicaid or food stamps. Not too many of them were ever getting cash welfare in the first place, but even that has dropped off considerably. And child care is the big thing that we really advocate for. If you want to keep people working, you need to do something there. Again, we don't put state money into that. It's all federal. So we really would be concerned about federal tax cuts endangering that kind of funding source.
How did the people Governor Bush, before he was president, appoint in Texas influence the availability of social services, a social safety net?
Well, a lot of the rules about who can get any kind of safety net program, there's the federal laws that apply to eligibility, but then the state has a lot of leeway in terms of deciding how rigorous it makes the application process. And Texas, by any account, has one of the toughest certification or eligibility processes for getting children's Medicaid or food stamps. You're pretty much investigated in either case. For children's Medicaid, we are one of the few states that still requires an assets test and that hasn't dropped a face-to-face interview. Right now, the legislature is considering changing those, but the price tag would be pretty big because in the past, our state budget has kind of depended on nobody getting those programs, relatively speaking. So if we made it easier for children to get Medicaid, it would have a huge budget effect because we just haven't done that in the past. So the people in charge of the agencies, what they're concerned about is error rates and things that the federal government looks at very closely to make sure that people who aren't eligible don't get these benefits. But at the same time, they've scared off a lot of people who really could use just a little help. Minimum wage only gets you to about, I think it's about $11,000 a year. Poverty for a family of three is almost $14,000. So even if you're working full-time, you could still need some help. The people in charge of the agencies, either they don't seem to recognize that or they've been told keep the welfare caseloads down because people equate welfare caseloads with poverty, and that's just not the same thing in Texas.
Well, as we move from Texas nationally, looking at how the people Bush appointed as governor influenced the availability of social services, let's look at the people he appointed while he is president, namely Tommy Thompson to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Pat Gowans is with us, joining us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and she's the director of Welfare Warriors and editor of Welfare Mother's Voice. Pat Gowans, you have dealt with Tommy Thompson as the governor of Wisconsin for a long time. What does his appointment to Health and Human Services mean?
It's a very scary thing, I think, for the nation. The mothers and children and all the low-wage workers and the disabled folks in Wisconsin have been just suffering tremendously since Thompson began his attacks on the poor, basically, especially anyone who needs any kind of public benefits. And, we've seen a tremendous amount of homelessness. For instance, we've got 3,000 evictions a year compared to only 700 before the welfare reform began in 1996. We are seeing a tremendous amount of what they call the working poor, the low-wage workers who have no public benefits. Only a quarter of the people in Wisconsin who are eligible for food stamps now receive them because of the welfare reform that basically discourages everyone at the front line from getting any kind of public benefits. We're watching a third of the women who've been removed from the welfare rolls have absolutely no income. No one's knowing how they're surviving. only 16% of the moms who've been removed from welfare have over a poverty-level income. This is certainly not a success to see this kind of suffering. Disabled children and disabled mothers are actually being sent to early graves. Women with disabilities who are not yet on Social Security are being forced to work off welfare grants, and in really brutal and ruthless ways. Women who are already single are trying to raise children and facing disabilities and raising children alone, and yet, you know, that's always been about a third of the population on welfare, the women with a variety of disabilities, and there's absolutely no compassion, no recognition. Even women who are dying are told you have to work off any kind of welfare support that you receive. So the suffering of the people is tremendous, and the suffering of the taxpayers is actually invisible and unrecognized. In Wisconsin, we have only a tenth as many folks getting any kind of public benefits, and yet the welfare roll, the cost of welfare has just been skyrocketing over the last 15 years since Thompson was the head of our state, the governor of our state. For instance, before he became governor, we were spending $548 million on 300,000 folks, mostly mothers and children who got some form of child support through the AFDC system. Now, 15 years later, we're paying $600 million for less than 35,000 people getting any form of support. So that's 10 times fewer people, and yet we're spending $50 million more dollars. So what we're looking at is this just tremendous bloated bureaucracy, bloated welfare empire that's waging war on the poor while generating this massive amount of money that the taxpayers are funding to pay for administration. Our administration went up from 4% to 55%. We have now privatized welfare in Milwaukee. All of the previous county public workers who used to administer welfare are all still there, and yet they don't do any of the cash administration. They only do food stamps and Medicaid. And we have five private agencies like the Goodwill and YWCA and UMOS, OIC, and Maximus. These private for-profit agencies now are administering welfare, even though there's nearly no one on welfare anymore. We have counties all over Wisconsin where there's literally only five families on welfare, and yet that entire giant administration is still intact.
Bat Gowans, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back to this discussion. Bat Gowans, director of Welfare Warriors from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We're also joined on the phone by Ellen Frank, professor at Emmanuel College in Boston, Massachusetts, and a member of the Dollars and Cents Collective. And with us is Eva DeLuna, who is an analyst for the Center for Public Policy Priorities, an advocacy group for poor Texans. We'll be joined by others in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. And before we go back to our guests, we're going to listen to Pat Gowan's answering machine at Welfare Warriors. We've just given her a call.
Shame on Wisconsin, shame on Thompson. Mothers in this state are forced to leave our tiny infants mourning till it's late. That's hate, hate. We work slave jobs and we brave jobs, no paycheck in our name. Unite, mothers, fight to stop Wisconsin's shame. Leave a message for the Welfare Warriors after the beep.
And that was Pat Gowans. Pat Gowans, you there? Pat Gowans?
Yes.
Did you write that song?
I didn't write it, but I did sing it. One of our mothers named Linda Ray did a lot of the writing of the songs that we do a lot of singing to try and keep from crying, I guess. And she's written a lot of the words for our songs. That's actually our On Wisconsin football song, the tune.
You've taken on Tommy Thompson for years. I remember at the beginning of Democracy Now! Having you on in a debate with one of his top-level officials in Washington, D.C. What has been his in Wisconsin, what has been his response to your critique over the years, showing what it has meant to knock people off welfare?
Well, he's very heartless. Human being, very cold person. He basically says, oh, the welfare warriors never agree with anything I say, and they're always wrong. he has an attitude towards the poor people, and I think the city of Milwaukee, which comprises a large percent of the poor people in Wisconsin, he said, let's stick it to him when he was traveling around the state of Wisconsin, saying he was going to have us pay for a stadium for his, you know, wealthy friends to be able to be indoors when they watch baseball or whatever the reason was they needed a new stadium. And I think the stick-it-to-him attitude is pretty clear. He's, absolutely heartless. This bloated bureaucracy he's created, you know, has just created some of the most heartless statistics and suffering. For instance, our infant mortality rate now in Milwaukee in the African-American community has increased 37% since 1997 when our welfare reform program began. And, you know, this is absolutely going against all the trends of infant mortality in the United States. And it means what we're losing is 26 babies a year since 1997. We've lost about 100 kids strictly and only because of welfare reform. So we're literally watching death. And this is only the kids who we know about who are under one. There's a lot of other children and disabled mothers who are dying who are over one, but there aren't any statistics that would measure that death rate.
Let's go up to Boston for a minute. Interestingly, with a lead about New York, the headline last week in the paper in the New York Times, the number of homeless people lodging nightly in the New York City shelter system this winter has risen above 25,000, the most since the late 1980s, according to city figures, with the largest increases coming among women and children over the last few years. Officials say no single factor explains the increase in families seeking shelter. Likely explanations include sharply rising housing costs and an economic boom, a subway advertisement campaign that encourages victims of domestic violence to seek help, more court orders for eviction, and declines in subsidized housing. Interesting, no mention is made of welfare reform. And the person who put together those figures, Dennis Culhane, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, shows that by far, and he looked at the computerized shelter system data for New York and Philadelphia, he shows that by far the most likely person to become homeless in both cities is a poor black child younger than 5. Lynn Peterson, assistant director of Women's Institute for Housing and Economic Development in Boston, is this what you're finding as well?
Definitely. Here in Boston, our housing prices have just gone through the roof. And housing and child care are two of the most exorbitant costs for families. And welfare reform has been basically moving people off the rolls and into jobs that pay an average of $8 an hour, which is a little bit higher than minimum wage. But a study here has shown that you would need to work 3 full-time minimum wage jobs just to afford an apartment in the Boston area. So you can see there's just this tremendous gap.
The figures that this professor at the University of Pennsylvania came up with are pretty astounding, showing that one out of every three black children born poor in America's largest cities will stay in a homeless shelter before they enter the first grade.
Well, the homelessness has been rising every year, and it's doubled between 1990 and 1997, particularly young families. And people are staying at least a year, sometimes longer, before they can actually get a subsidy. What we're finding now is that subsidies have no value. Subsidies are capped at a certain rent level, and those rent levels are well below what's available. So people are getting basically a useless subsidy after waiting for so long and having to make a choice of relocating to another community, usually some of the more depressed towns outside of Boston, or giving up their subsidy and just trying to cram in with people, live in substandard housing. So, you know, it's dire.
You deal with solutions, how to help people. Your organization looks at the problems of poverty and homelessness by first asking those affected what they need and then developing a comprehensive approach to solutions. Can you talk about how your strategy differs from the government approach?
Yeah, we take a multi-pronged approach, and we did a pretty thorough strategic plan, really as a result of welfare reform, looking at the external environment, and we interviewed and spoke to people who are affected by it. And the multi-pronged approach is that first, people need affordable housing, and we do develop housing. And it takes a long time to compile all the subsidies together to get this housing built. The second part is the affordable child care. And we, through, for example, the Transition to Work Collaborative that we're involved in, the caseworkers there try to get the homeless people in shelters a subsidized child care space. We also have a family child care training program where we're training women on welfare to become family child care providers to try to help meet their income need and the huge need for child care. And then another component is the whole job training and education. And we are seeing that families really need to earn $15 or $18 an hour to make it in Massachusetts. So one strategy we have is helping women attend college, really despite welfare reform, which here discourages people from attending college. And we found that as women are going to school, they're gaining confidence, they're making connections, although they're going to school and having to work at the same time, which is a huge burden. But they are coming out with jobs that pay high 20s, low 30s, which is much better than the $8 an hour job other folks are getting. So I guess what we see is that it requires a huge level of investment on all these fronts, housing, child care, job training, and education, to enable a family to reach self-sufficiency. Cutting the welfare rolls just for the sake of cutting the welfare rolls might save the government money, but if we really want to move people beyond poverty, it's going to cost the government more money than what they're paying now.
And what do you see George Bush's $1.6 trillion tax proposal doing? How would you see it affecting your work?
Right. I mean, I totally agree with what Eva DeLuna said. How can we even talk about a surplus when we have dire needs? We've had no increase in funding for HUD to do housing development. You know, the numbers of homelessness just keep increasing. So it's a pretty grim prospect, and I think we have to educate people to see that we don't really have a surplus. We have huge needs. And the so-called boom in the economy has left a lot of people behind, in fact made it worse for people as real estate's gone out of reach.
Charity Krause also joins us now from Chicago, Illinois, editor of Streetwise, which is a weekly street newspaper whose mission is to empower the homeless to self-sufficiency through employment. Can you talk about how you've been dealing with the new administration, how you've been covering it, and also how your organization, what kind of solutions you offer?
Okay, well, our organization has a two-pronged approach. I suppose we are a direct service provider in that we do offer referrals to homeless men and women who come into our organization. We also provide them with a means of transitional employment through the sale of our paper. Our vendors buy the paper for 35 cents in addition for each issue, and they sell it for $1, keeping the profits. And then our paper also functions as a sort of information vehicle for issues pertaining to homelessness, poverty, and other social economic justice issues that, link homelessness in Chicago to homelessness elsewhere. Our organization, I think, is kind of following the mold that is going to be encouraged for social service providers in the future, which is to seek outside philanthropic support as opposed to any sort of government or state funding. And I think that what we're experiencing right now with our paper is kind of indicative of some of the problems that social service providers are going to be experiencing a great deal more in the upcoming years. As you kind of court these sort of private funders, a lot of times who are backed by corporate dollars, it forces your organization a lot of times to consider things that might not be in line with the original mission of the paper or, for in our case, in the original mission of our paper, or in line with some of the original programs that the papers had. I think that one thing that hasn't been talked about today that I think is very important for a lot of service providers, particularly when we're talking about women, but also when we're talking about poor and or homeless gays and lesbians as well, is the sort of impact that Bush's increased reliance on faith-based action proposals and, you know, Office for Faith-Based Action and also the expansion of charitable choice. This is something we've already encountered here in Chicago. I've had several people call me up and say that even though there hasn't been any specific change in the legislation yet, there is a sort of encouragement among certain service providers, especially I can think in particular of two domestic violence shelters in Chicago, where you have social workers basically keeping from acknowledging resources that come from family planning to women who say they might be considering pregnancy termination because they already have so many children and they can't take care of them. And using this as immoralizing why they shouldn't take these decisions into account, I think that provides a sort of element to some of the Bush proposals that is something that should definitely be looked at in the future. It's as though poor people aren't entitled to the same sort of freedom and protections, separating church and state, and also protecting what is accessible under the law, as at least abortion is currently. But in our organization in particular, because we have such a reliance on corporate dollars, one of the things we're experiencing is that our organization has basically been pursuing some very pro-corporate initiatives. In particular, one thing that is being heavily put onto us is this thing called the Socially Responsible Advertisers Initiative. Basically, this initiative will offer advertising to anybody who can afford it, and then will give them this label as a socially responsible advertiser because their dollars will presumably be put to socially responsible programs within the organization. At the same time this initiative has been launched, we in the editorial department of the paper have been consistently told to lay off covering certain issues, particularly ones that might give negative coverage to some of our corporate funders. And this has resulted currently in a situation where you have had staff, both in editorial and the rest of the organization, filing grievances for, among other things, this particular future focus of the organization. And it's had negative consequences both on the paper and also on the public's perception of the vendors who are selling the paper.
Huh. So a number of people have been locked out?
Well, yes, actually, in the last week, after we filed these grievances, we only have two full-time members of our editorial staff, and the two of us were locked out, and the rest of the editorial department that is basically working on a contractual basis was fired.
So this was to protest advertisers having to sort of go easy on the people who are advertising.
Right, among other things. But, yeah, that was definitely the main focus of our demonstrations. I think that we know from the positive response we've gotten from readers and also from our vendors selling the paper that the fact that we offer critical coverage of issues like globalization and police brutality and also other economic and social justice issues, this is something that, you know, basically helps us create a product that isn't available in the city under any other means, and also helps provide a connection between the vendor.
The head of your board changed an editorial?
It wasn't our board, actually. It was our executive director. But, yeah, after we'd been called in on Thursday after, you know, they couldn't get the paper out in time. Its production deadline was Thursday afternoon. We did get the paper together. We had put an editorial in addressing the fact that this had been put in the press. And after he seized the disc from us at the end of the day, we did find out that he had changed our editorial, taken it out, and put his own in.
You also singled out Shell Oil protesting its advertising in Streetwise?
Throughout the last couple of years, we've had several stories that have documented the sort of hypocrisy, so to speak, of the fact that they are lauded as a sort of socially responsible company because they invest in literacy programs in urban cities, while their policies, you know, throughout Africa, render many people homeless or dead. We've kind of covered these things consistently, and we were told to lay off of them for a while, but now more in particular, we've been told that it's not going to be to anyone's advantage if we keep beating up on our corporate partners, direct quote, and as such, do we need to lay off such coverage?
Well, Charity Krause, I want to thank you for being with us, especially interesting as Nigerian people, the country of Nigeria, is watching hearings on television around Shell and the issue of corporate responsibility. Charity Krause of Streetwise, thank you. Eva DeLuna, talking to us from Texas, analyst for the Center for Public Policy Priorities in Austin. Lynn Peterson, Assistant Director of the Women's Institute for Housing and Economic Development in Boston. Ellen Frank of Emmanuel College in Boston, member of the Dollars and Cents Collective. And Pat Gowans, joining us from Milwaukee, of Welfare Warriors. A very interesting roundtable on the issue of the $1.6 trillion tax cut proposed by President Bush and the issue of homelessness around the country. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the last month in Ecuador, 10,000 indigenous people descended on the nation's capital, Quito, and took over the Polytechnic University. All over the country, people protested. Military troops and police cracked down. At least four indigenous people were killed. They were protesting economic austerity measures being imposed by the International Monetary Fund. This past week, the Confederation of Indigenous Nations of Ecuador, known as CONAI, reached an agreement with the government. As part of the IMF's ongoing structural adjustment program, the government had removed subsidies for cooking fuel and gasoline in December. Prices rose dramatically, with public transportation costs increasing by 75%. The IMF required the measures as a precondition for a $300 million loan to the poverty-stricken country. Already, Ecuador has imposed wage restraints and begun the privatization of Social Security and the oil and electricity industries. Kunai, joined by farm workers and students, responded by taking to the streets. The marches, 10,000 in Quito, all over the country, and people killed. The IMF public relations official for the region refused to join us today, saying the issue was too complicated and that the IMF is not requiring anything of Ecuador. The ambassador of Ecuador also refused to discuss the issue, but we are joined by two people. Stephanie Weinberg is the program associate at Development Gap, and Dr. Juan Fernando Terán joins us from Quito. He's an economic consultant with the Structural Adjustment Participatory Review Network, known as SAPRIN. Dr. Juan Fernando Terán, what do you think of the agreement that has just been reached?
Thank you. Well, I think that the agreement has calmed down the situation right now. However, it is not enough to solve the structural problems that our people is facing. I think that if we don't attack poverty, we will have more riots, more uprisings in the future.
Could you describe what has been happening in Ecuador in the last month?
Yes. Everything began with some rises of prices. For example, there was a rise of almost 75% of the price of gasoline, and also was a rise of bus fares. So these measures were the fire for the beginning of the rising, because our population right now is living under extreme poverty. So these kind of supposedly legal measures are really a huge impact, a huge hit on our popular economy. So the last 2 weeks, there was almost 10,000 indigenous people in the city asking for avoiding these kind of measures. There was a lot of repression around here. We don't know how many dead people there are. It is said that there were 7 people dead and more than 20 people with problems in their physical situation. But after some days of this kind of struggle, the government agreed to the indigenous movement demands, and right now everything is on calm.
Stephanie Weinberg, what is your take on the agreement that was reached between the Confederation of Indigenous Nations of Ecuador and the Ecuadorian government?
Well, I think the important thing to emphasize here, as Juan Fernando was saying, that also these measures, the economic measures that were announced, are part of an ongoing program of structural adjustment backed by and even imposed by the International Monetary Fund, supported by the World Bank as well. These agreements that were recently reached, I think one of the important points to point out, as well as rolling back somewhat some of the price increases that Juan Fernando mentioned, they also include other measures that run counter to the International Monetary Fund prescriptions for Ecuador. There's some specific measures for example, restructuring the National Development Bank and investing in loans on preferential terms to small-scale businesses, a tax reform or a dialogue on the tax reform that may run counter to what the IMF is recommending. So I think that the positive part of these agreements is that it shows that the government, not very willingly, after much pressure and after initially responding by repression to legitimate public protests, has now reached an agreement with large representatives of large segments of society. And I think that the importance is in that showing that citizens from all around the country and their governments need to reach agreements on their own economic program, and the international financial institutions need to give governments the space to do that and refrain from imposing policies that have been shown to be detrimental to large segments of their societies.
Dr. Juan Fernando Terán, in Quito, Ecuador, what is your response to that, that overall this is showing that indigenous people, that people in Ecuador are having an effect on these economic policies through their protest?
Well, I think that the agreement is good in several senses. However, let me tell you something. The real problem, we have two real problems around here. The first one is that the IMF and the World Bank are coming every year to this country asking for the same measures. And this is the third year running that we have riots and that we have also these kind of measures. So what I think is important to understand is that structural adjustment policies just don't work in this country. If we don't change these kind of policies, we will have the same problems every time, every year. The second real problem we have around here is that our ruling class cannot understand what the indigenous culture is. They think that the indigenous are just demanding lower prices, and that is not the problem. The indigenous movement is asking for a new democracy, for a democracy without racism, for a democracy with opportunities for all. And that's their deep demand. So these deep demands has not been addressed by the government. Everything is just a promise, and that's all. So what I think that we have to do as Ecuadorians is to really have a new kind of view about what is development and what is a democracy for everybody and not just for the white, upper, and urban classes.
Let me ask you, the coup that happened last year where the military allied with indigenous people, the attempted coup, what has happened since then with the military firing on the people?
Well, let me tell you, the people who were involved in the coup d'etat the last year, the military, I mean, they were fired from the army. So the army right now is with a different kind of command. And that's why you can understand there was a lot of repression in this last week. It's a different kind of military right now.
Dr. Juan Fernando Terán in Quito, Ecuador, how does the U.S. support of $1.3 billion going to Colombia impact on Ecuador in the so-called war on drugs in Colombia, but what many people see as a shoring up of the Colombian military and paramilitaries there?
Well, the conflict in Colombia is another problem we have right now, in the sense that in order to respond to that kind of threat, the government is, and the state, I mean, the state is more worried about what is going on in the frontier rather than worry about what is happening with the poor population. So they are merging two kind of problems in this country. One is the indigenous problem, and the other is the Colombia plan. And I don't know how is this going to evolve, in the sense that if things go worse, that will be more problems for the indigenous people and for the people who are living in the countryside. The amount of money that we can have or receive from the United States is used for military purposes. It is not used for development. And that is important to stress, because in our case, in Ecuador, the Colombia plan is almost completely a military plan. So it is not a development plan. And that's the difference between us and the Colombians.
What about the base that is being protested in Ecuador right now, the U.S. military base? Can you describe what's happening there?
The U.S. military base, it is located in the coastal zone in Ecuador. And, well, it is right now, it is not motive of protest, but it was a motive of protest in the last year. Right now, we have the main fear in the Amazonas zone because the conflict in Colombia is mostly in the Amazonas. So I think that a scenario will change from the Sierra, from the highlands, to the Amazonas, which is very bad in the sense that it is an ecological fragile zone. And we have a lot of population, indigenous, I mean, in that place.
Amy?
Yes, Stephanie Weinberg.
I just wanted to add to that. I was recently in December in Ecuador near the border with Colombia, and it's very clear that those are some of the poorest communities along the border on the coastal region as well as in the Amazon. And it was very clear to me people were aware of Plan Colombia, but they were not getting any because I think it's said oftentimes that Plan Colombia is investing resources in social development. I can say that the population in those border regions in Ecuador has seen no social investment, and certainly not coming from resources from Plan Colombia.
Finally, Dr. Juan Fernando Terán, what would you like to see in Ecuador right now? What would democracy look like?
Democracy right now, I mean right now, is just a kind of illusion. Let me tell you this. Every year, the ruling class violates our constitution as a way to get an easy way of transferring rents, resources from the public budget to some private sectors. So that kind of behavior is not very responsible. There is no accountability in this country. There is also the problem that most laws are not consulted with the people. And there are important laws about privatization of public health, for example, which will have a lot of impact, and the people is just looking this as an observer. So it is important to understand that, and unlike the United States, we don't have a real way of democracy. We have to construct that democracy in this country. There is a lot of legal problems, and the first ones who are creating these problems are the upper classes. The indigenous are not the source of the problem. They are just responding to this kind of ruling class behavior.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you, Amy. I don't know whether I might have a chance to just add one thing at the end.
Yes, go ahead.
Just to say that in terms of the future of the economy and situation in Ecuador, the SAPRA network has been working with the World Bank and government to assess the impact of these type of economic policies in Ecuador over the past 20 years. The results of that research show very clearly the negative impact, and what we think in terms of the recent protests clearly show that these policies are no longer viable. And what I think the agreements that have just been reached between the government and indigenous movements, supported by many other social sectors, are an indication now of the need to open a national dialogue on the future of economic policy, and particularly for the international financial institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, to respect the decisions taken nationally and to allow the flexibility for countries to develop their own economic programs that may run counter to the typical adjustment prescriptions by the IMF and World Bank.
Well, thank you both very much again for being with us. Stephanie Weinberg of the Development Gap, your website?
Yes, it's the
real fast
developmentgap.org, or Saprin is Saprin, SAPRIN.org.
Great. And Dr. Juan Fernando Terán with Saprin in Quito, Ecuador, the Structural Adjustment Participatory Review Initiative Network. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!